busy staff, believing that they are, as usual, going to be able to furnish all of us with the required documents so that we can be ready to start. Yes, let me declare this a very important session of our Committee on Social Development, and also take an opportunity of saying to you, honorable members, thank you very much for honoring this session as well. I know that you belong to many committees, and also you are also subjected to trainings and other sessions that will empower your daily work. But for having prioritized coming to this committee should not be just a right, but a privilege for Chair to say thank you once more for your support. I then wish to welcome our very important guest, the South African Medical Research Council members, who are doing this work in partnership with our government and in support for the welfare of our poor and marginalized. So you are very welcome, Professor Glenda Gray and Professor Nima Abrahams. I only hope I've pronounced properly. So this is your home. We expect your call at any time when you think duty calls, because you're looking after the vulnerable, after the defenseless, those who cannot defend themselves. And today you've brought another one of many, many reports you've done before in your daily research work. So you are welcome, you are free to take the platform and to inform us what has come out of your study. But I say so, I say many, many reports, because research is an ongoing process. It might be formally, it might be informally, it might be participatory, it might be literature review, it might be a desktop, but it's an ongoing part of our life. We always make general observations, but at the end of the day, we have to scientifically prove what we argue is happening. So you've given us a better weapon to say this is a scientific report. It tells us, it's our mirror, what is happening outside there. So I welcome you, and I say, honorable members, the professors are here. Can they talk to us? Thank you very much.
Is this working? Thank you very much. We are very privileged to be here, honorable Chair.
Just a minute. This lecture reminds me of reading apologies and other things, but I think I neglected that area deliberately, because we are not going to vote in any way. All we are here for our own empowerment. So the attendance register will give us who was here, who was not here. So thank you very much. Can we agree on that one?
Yes.
So in chasing the time, I'm sorry for interference. Thank you. Can you continue?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We're very privileged to be here, and we are gratified that this portfolio committee values children and is concerned about violence against children. And so this presentation will be shared by both myself and Naima Abrahams. I'm a pediatrician by training. I trained at Kothani Baragwanath Hospital, and I was the head of the perinatal HIV research unit until I became the president of the Medical Research Council. Most of my work has been in HIV and HIV prevention, and I have a special interest in adolescents and HIV and what makes adolescents resilient to HIV acquisition, and what are the social determinants that make adolescents vulnerable in South Africa to getting HIV? And so I've worked mostly with adolescents. Naima has worked both in children and in adolescents and in women. She works in violence against women. And so we hope that we can show you some of the issues around child violence in South Africa. So the first question, you know, just to paint the picture, and because I'm a scientist, you know, I always, you know, want to go from the big to the little. And before we show the data, just to show the kind of determinants around which we're looking at. And so when we ask the question, what is violence against children, it could be physical violence, it could be sexual violence, and it could be psychological violence. And even psychological violence is violence against children. And when we look at this, we see child murders or homicide, we see sexual exploitation and trafficking, we see harmful traditional and cultural practices, child labor and bullying, even bullying at school, bullying by teachers, and bullying by community is a form of violence against children. If you look at violence against children, who perpetrates violence against children? And this could be adults. And this is against either physical or emotional abuse, and it could be peers, and they could be involved in physical, verbal, or indirect ways can traumatize children. And what does this do? You know, if children are exposed to psychological, emotional, physical, or sexual violence, what does this do to our youth? It increases their susceptibility to suicide. Substance abuse, alcohol abuse, delinquent behavior, failure at school, mental health problems, depression, and conduct problems. And so it affects the ability of a child to become a normal adult and to have a productive life. And that's why it's important for us to address and find ways to prevent violence in children. So what kind of violence do children have throughout their lifespan? So when you're a baby, you're vulnerable to infanticide. That means a child, you know, a baby being killed, or abandonment. And we see this from birth to 1 year, that children can either be abandoned or they can be killed. Between birth and 17 years old, we can see child abuse and neglect. From birth to 17 years old, we see sexual abuse. When children become adolescents, we may see dating violence. And we also, as boys become adolescents, we start to see male teenage violence. And we often see reports of this in newspapers, guns, children bringing guns to school, knives, gang-related violence. And how this affects the society in which children live. Where does it occur? So violence can occur at the individual level between a mother or a father or a sibling or an uncle or an aunt. It can occur in the home amongst family members. It can occur in the community, and we see this also particularly at school. And it can occur in institutions. So if children are placed in foster care, if they're in if they are caught for shoplifting or something, and they get put into a holding cell or into a juvenile area, children can be raped and face physical and mental abuse in all these areas. So what are the risk factors against violence against children? We know that. Sometimes society, you know, doesn't support families very well. We know often that women are, there's a lot of female-headed households. Women have to go out to work. There's not enough support for childcare. Sometimes the mom has to leave her children alone in the house while she goes to work. She's scared of their safety, so she may lock the door. There may be a fire, and the child may die because the mother does not have social support. And so we see that some of the risk factors is society, and that we have norms that may provoke violence, and there may be gender issues where that society promotes the fact that that it's okay to admonish or shout at a woman or hit her. Sometimes we all grow up in families where we've seen our mother being beaten, and so we kind of think it's normal. So sometimes society issues perpetuate the issues around violence. And sometimes there are cultural beliefs and practices that deny the rights of children. You know, in certain parts of the world, if you're only allowed to have one child and you favour a boy child, if you have a girl child, you know, you may subject that child to an infanticide because it's not the right sex. And so a girl child has a chance of dying because she wasn't born as a boy child and you're only allowed to have one child. So we see throughout the world there are cultural practices and societal norms that make children vulnerable to being killed. In our community, we tolerate a certain amount of violence. We sometimes think that violence is normal. We see a lot of gender and social inequality, which impacts violence. Lack of adequate housing and lack of adequate support perpetuate violence in a community. And poverty, you know, with high rates of unemployment or in families where women have to go out to work and they don't have anyone to look after their children while they go to work, these children are susceptible to violence. And obviously we also know that in poor countries the lack of social support for families, the lack of counselling and supporting women in their parenting role makes children susceptible to violence. In terms of relationship, we know that family conflict causes violence in the family or causes abuse or bullying. Poor supervision, sometimes a mother has, as I've mentioned before, has to go out to work. There's no one to look after her children. She can't afford childcare. The children have to stay at home by themselves, unsupervised, and they can be preyed on by predators. A emotionally detached parenting, sometimes if you have teenage pregnancy, you may not have formed a good bond with your child, and if you are detached as a parent, there's no bonding, that can make the child more susceptible to being abused. Substance abuse by the caregiver, if a parent or a caregiver is drunk or taking drugs, they can't adequately look after the child, and the child then becomes vulnerable for violence. If we have harsh discipline, sometimes we grew up in families where we were beaten, and we go to school where we get caned, and that kind of way to discipline children can impact on them emotionally. Also, if the carer, we have a lot of mental health issues, poorly supported people with mental health issues, and if there is mental health issues in the mother, if she's depressed, it can also make children susceptible to violence. And obviously, if a woman is isolated or a parent is isolated, being isolated without support, can have an impact on children. So all the relationship issues can be a risk factor of violence against women. At an individual level, obviously the age of the child. We'll show you some of our data. When you're under one, you're at risk of being abandoned or being killed. If you're a girl child, sometimes you're more risk to being abused than if you're a boy child. If you're an unwanted child, you're more likely to be abused by your family. If you have disability, I'm sure that you've read in the newspapers that sometimes mentally retarded girls have been raped. So if you have disabilities, or if you're a child that is hyperactive or unruly and naughty, and sometimes those children are more susceptible to abuse because they may be disciplined physically, and so that makes a child more susceptible. So those are all the risk factors for abuse. We're now going to talk to you about child murders. I'm going to ask Naima to address this part of the presentation. But I want to warn you that you'll be very sad when you see these figures, because you'll see that South Africa has a lot of work to do in terms of trying to prevent child murders.
Thank you very much for that introduction. So I will focus on child murders in South Africa. And in your pack, we have given you a research brief. It's called Child Homicide Patterns in South Africa. And I will be specifically talking about the study that we've done. I'm not presenting you slides on the methodology because we have so much research data, but I just want to very briefly explain to you how we came, how we got these figures, because the figures is very distressing, and if you don't believe that it's based on sound research, you might disbelieve it. So what we did, we have done a female homicide study before, and that's when we were able to determine how big is the problem of femicide in the country, and I presented previously to the previous committee on that. When we repeated the femicide study in 2009, we decided to add children. We decided that we wanted to see what is the problem of children being murdered in our country. So what we did, we took a sample of mortuaries in the country. At the sample of mortuaries, we collected and identified all the children that were murdered and that were had a post-mortem done. Then we took the case number for each of the children that we found in the mortuaries. We spoke to the investigating officer to identify whether they knew what happened, what were the circumstances of the child. And that's how we came across this data. So we can say we work across the provinces. So all the provinces were included, but our sample size was not big enough for us to be able to say this province has got a bigger figure or that figure. It requires a lot more money to do a bigger sample. So all we've got is what happens in South Africa nationally. And this represents 2009 figures. So what we found in 2009, more than 1,000 children under and with children, we mean from 0 to 18 years old, were murdered in the country. If we take it in ordinary terms, that is 3 children per day in South Africa. I've given you the rate of 5.5 per 100,000, and the reason why we calculate that is because it's a very useful way to compare what happens in other parts of the world. It's also useful that if we do the study again, we're able to see, did that rate go up or did it come down? And that's why we talk about 5.5 murders per 100,000 children. Note that the global rate is actually half that. When we look at children, when we look at the boy child, we see the boy child has got a higher rate, higher than the overall rate. And this really, and I'll show you soon, it's driven by teens, by older boys, the boys from 15 years onwards, that follows a very similar pattern of homicide with adult men. So they start to mimic what's happening in young men already in terms of homicide. And the female rate is slightly lower. Very particularly, what we wanted to know, we were most interested to know what was the circumstances of that death. We wanted to know what happened, who was the perpetrator in that situation. And we were very surprised when we found that 45% of all the children murdered, just under 500, were murdered in circumstances of child abuse and child neglect. Now, this is actually quite similar to what we find internationally. This is what they find internationally as well, that when children are murdered, they are very likely to be murdered by somebody who takes care of them and a carer. And actually, mothers are the most common perpetrators. If we look at the age profiling, in the pie you can see that almost two-thirds of the children who were killed in circumstances of child abuse and neglect were under the age of 5 years old. And the rest were distributed amongst the other age groups. So again, like Honorable Chair said that right at the beginning, it's the younger child that are most vulnerable to these kinds of murders if we look at the age patterns in terms of child abuse. And what I'm presenting here is again the ages, but I'm dividing it up by boys and girls. So if you look at the under 5 year age group, you will see that there was a very similar proportion of boys and girls under 5. But as the children get older, the 5 to 9 year olds and the 10 to 14 year olds, we see the darker shaded bar, and we see that here girls were predominantly, they were 2/3 of all the 5 to 9 year olds and the 10 and 11 year olds were girls that were being abused. when you look at the older group, you see it also very similarly. And then I want to say what we find is rape homicides. We know a lot about rape homicides in this country because it's something commonly reported in our media. But what we found in our group of children, in the more than 1,000 children that we identified, about 10%, which is just over 100, there were very clear evidence that a rape has also happened. And this, when we look at boys and girls, it's 25% of the cases that were actually girls, and only 1.4 was boys. That is the, in a nutshell, that I'm telling the information around child murders. There is a lot more information in this brief, and I could talk to people also individually if they want us to tell them more around what the age patterns are. I'm now going to talk about child sexual abuse. Like we said earlier, it's a common problem, and where we see it common is just in our police statistics. This is police statistics. I apologize, it's a bit old. It's 2005 to 2006, but it hasn't changed much. Whatever comes through the police, between 40 and 50% of the cases being reported to police consistently in the last 10 years has been children under the age of 18 years. And it's still the same. So actually, when we go to our Tutuzelas and we do research there, and we want to do adult women, for example, we struggle to find adult women because what comes in is mainly children under the age of 18 years. And it's very important that we know this because our services must be geared to it. And I'll talk later about sexual assault services and how we do not have really specialists that actually can help children to deal with the mental health consequences of being sexually abused. What I'm showing here is, again, risk factors. And Glenda's already told you about the overall risk factors that has been found consistently in research. But very particularly, I think we need to identify what are the risk factors for child sexual abuse. And these three risk factors that I've identified here are very important because it links up so greatly with problems of health and social problems later in life. We have shown in research done by the MRC that a person who has report to us that they've been sexually abused as a child, they are more likely to also tell us that they started sex younger. So they are starting with sexual behavior at a younger age. This is consistent in many research. What we also found that people who report that they've been sexually abused as a child, we find that they have more risky behavior in terms of HIV. They have more sexual partners. They have more unprotected sex. So when we look at child violence against children, we really do need to think about the impact that happens and the consequences. We also see that people who report that they were abused as children sexually, we see a greater likelihood of teen pregnancies as well. So these are things that we really need to take cognizance as we really need to talk about prevention.
So we've showed you, so we've started off with the murders and we've gone to rape, and now we're going to talk about physical and emotional abuse in children and some of the data that we're finding. And so this is a result, this is some surveys that we've done to look at the issue around bullying and physical abuse. And you can see that in terms of physical abuse, which is being hit, being made to stand or kneel in an uncomfortable position for a long time, being slapped, pinched, pulled your hair or hurt you, or had a teacher beat you or punish you, you can see that a third of the children that were surveyed, just more than a third of the children surveyed, actually had a teacher that had beaten the child in the last 6 months. So you can see that it's very prevalent in schools, but also that you can see that a lot of our, you know, at least one in five children, you know, are facing physical abuse by caregivers and adults. If you look at the emotional abuse, you can see that children report that they've been singled out to do household chores instead of being at school or play. They've been threatened to be hurt or give you bad grades. So a teacher can threaten to hurt you or give you a bad grade if you don't behave. They say they were called ghosts or evil spirits or to harm you. They tell you they wish they did not have to look after you and make you feel like you're a burden, and make you feel unwelcome in the home, and say that you will be sent away or kicked out of the house if you don't behave, or call you dumb, lazy, or other names. And you can see 30% of the kids, 1 in 3 children, are called dumb, lazy, and horrible names. Children, in almost 1 in 5 children, are made to feel unwelcome in their home and said that they are a burden to the family. So you can see the kind of emotional abuse that some children face. If you have a look at the weekly figures, you can see that a fair amount of children are facing weekly abuse, or at least this kind of abuse once in a year, and this is the 2013 data. If you have a look at the prevalence of any form of physical or emotional abuse at the hands of adults at least once by children last year, you can see that it's a big amount, that just under 1/3 of boys and girls have faced physical abuse, and these are grade 8 students. And look at almost half the boys and girls had reported emotional abuse in the last year. So you can see that this is very prevalent amongst grade 8 students. If you have a look at any form of physical and emotional abuse at the hands of adults on a weekly basis, you can see that in terms of emotional abuse, almost 1 in 5 children are facing emotional abuse at least once a week at the hands of adults, and that physical abuse is around 10%. So that's about 1 in 10 children who are in grade 8, 13-year-olds, are facing physical abuse. So that's a fair amount. How many people are in the room? It's about 4 or 5 people. If we had to think this was a classroom. How many people? About, there are probably 3 or 4, if we had to think, there'd be 3 or 4 people, if this was a classroom, who would be saying, they're facing this kind of abuse. And when we looked at the physical and emotional abuse, we saw that the children, these are 13-year-olds that were surveyed, that they were likely to try and attempt suicide. They were using substance abuse, drug abuse. They were starting to use alcohol. They had delinquent behavior. They were stealing and being vandals. They had mental health problems like depression, and they had conduct problems. They weren't behaving well in the class or in the home. When we look at bullying, so we've gone from murders to sexual abuse to physical and emotional abuse by adults. But now when we look at bullying, so the kind of bullying which is usually bullying by your peers, if we have a look at any form of bullying, you can see that that children, are reporting that they are being punched, kicked, beaten up, hurt, and or being threatened. And that's 12%. That's more than 1 in 10 children had at least one episode of being physically bullied. Verbal bullying is much higher. Almost 1 in 3 children said people make fun of them, calling them names and swearing at them. And then also indirect bullying, so there's also indirect bullying where your peers will refuse to talk to you or break or steal something of yours or try and get you into trouble with your friends. And so you can see that's also very prevalent in South African schools. When you look at what physical bullying is associated with, so if you get physically bullied, you're more likely to try and attempt suicide. You're more likely to use alcohol, you're more likely to have delinquent behavior, mental health problems, and conduct problems. If in those adolescents who were faced with verbal bullying, they were more likely also to have suicide attempts, mental health problems, alcohol use, delinquent behavior, conduct disorders, and mental health problems. And the indirect bullying also is associated with suicide, delinquent behavior, mental health problems, and conduct problems. So you can see, no matter what kind of spectrum of bullying you have, this has really ramifications on the mental health of adolescents. We're going to go to maltreatment of children. So Naima's going to talk about the maltreatment of children.
Okay, it's really a extension of what we have been talking about. Because what I'm going to present here to you is really work that has come from the Gender and Health Research Unit, where we spoke to children in the Eastern Cape. It was we were doing an intervention, a stepping stones intervention, and we spoke to children on three occasions over a period of about 2 years. And we were able to speak to both boys and girls, these were young adults, and we asked them about the treatment that they experience as children. Now these areas like emotional neglect is not things that we just took from another questionnaire. We had focus groups with these boys and girls first to find out what are the experiences in the home and the school and their society, and ask them whether they agreed that it was abuse, and before we really used it in our questionnaire. So you might ask, I'm talking there about emotional neglect, and I'm only giving you the prevalence of emotional neglect that the boys and the girls spoke about, and only those that said they experienced it often or very often. There were those that said they never experienced it, for example, but I'm just showing you those that experienced it often or very often. Now you might say, what is emotional neglect and how is it different from emotional abuse? When we spoke to the people in the focus group, they identified for us three experiences that they have that which they considered as neglect on an emotional level. For example, they would have parents who are too drunk to take care of them. They can remember it happened to them when they were 10 years old or 5 years old. Or they were away from home for a very long time and parents didn't really know where they were and didn't really look for them. That was the second one. And the third one was they lived in many different households at different times. They identified those three things as emotional neglect. And you can see the high proportion of both boys and girls that said that they experienced that. Emotional abuse is more the traditional way that we measure it, things that people humiliate them, people say they're stupid, people say they're ugly, this is family members or people that are supposed to care for them. So you see that is slightly higher. Physical hardships, this is also something different from physical punishment. Physical punishment we know is being beaten with a stick or with a hand or being hurt. But physical hardship is things like not having food to eat. But it's a consequence of parents' neglect, or they didn't have clean clothes. They went to school with dirty clothes. So these were the things that they themselves identified for us. And then they also reported physical punishment, which is very common. 78 and 84% of the children said, and it keeps in line with what Glenda reported from another study with the children at the schools. Punishing our children physically is a common thing still in South Africa. Okay? And then there is sexual abuse. And then we ask them also about, sexual abuse twice there. The one was adding sometimes. You see the lower ones? We added sometimes, often, or very often. Then you see it going up quite high. Another very useful way that we found in the research to identify sexual violence during childhood was to ask young people or to ask even adults, asking them, when you had your first sexual encounter, was that sexual encounter forced? Okay, and people were actually able to tell us. They were happy to if you do research in a way where you do not, you are not in a way where you affect their dignity, they are comfortable, they're able to tell you this information. So in the Eastern Cape, the same group of children that told us about the emotional neglect and abuse, 18.8 of the girls said that the first time they had sex, they felt they were forced or tricked, and 1.4 of the boys said that. In a second study in Khayelitsha that we did way early when we started actually all this work in 95, we spoke to pregnant and non-pregnant women, and the pregnant teenagers were way more higher, more likely to say that their first encounter of sex was forced. When the work was done in Soweto, we spoke to women in antenatal care. It was a study that Glenda was involved in. There again, the girls, the women, adult women, were telling us about the proportion of them who felt that their first sexual encounter was forced. And in Gauteng, a more recent study, it was also 8.5%. So what I'm trying to say here, it's consistent across many studies that we find that forced sex at the first encounter was forced under the age of 18. Now what I want to say that over the many years of work that we've done on gender-based violence, our unit mainly does gender-based violence work, but we cannot ignore the fact that violence against children is so much part of the work that we do on violence against women. You cannot separate it. You cannot help the woman only. Or if invariably, if there's a partner that's abusive, he's also abusing the children, a father. So we have seen that witnessing abuse of one's mother is associated with perpetrating violence later as an adult. These are young boys. I did work with men where I asked them about whether they perpetrated violence against their partners, and I asked them about their childhood. A third of them were more likely to perpetrate if they witnessed abuse when they were children. We also see that women, if they witness abuse, they also more likely to experience violence. So it's something about their self-esteem. It's about them accepting the norms of what they've seen with their mother. We've also seen other research has shown that child sexual abuse and forced sex intercourse also lead to subsequent physical and sexual violence. Also by non-partners. We often talk about violence by partners, but also being abused by somebody who's not your partner. These invariably could be a father, a grandfather, somebody you know. Very seldom in children is it a stranger. It's more likely somebody they know. And I've told you already that a childhood exposure to violence may increase acceptance of the violence as a victim and as a perpetrator. I want to now move on to the psychological impact of sexual assault. We did a study when we wanted primarily to find out what was the impact of mental health after a sexual assault has been reported. We spoke to children 8 to 17 years old, and we spoke to their caregivers, mothers, or whoever's taking care of them. And we actually tested and measured PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, which is very common mental health that happens after a traumatic event, and we measured anxiety and we measured depression. One in four children still showed clinical, that means if a clinician, a doctor or a psychologist had to test them, had higher levels of anxiety nearly 6 months after the event, right? PTSD, about 43.3% of the children were also showing symptoms of PTSD 6 months after the event. But what was most disturbing, so here we could show very, very clearly that mental health happens to children, because very often we think, oh, children recover, they're resilient. What was most concerning is that when we spoke to these children and their caregivers at 6 months, and we asked them about whether they were in care, we asked them whether they were accessing our services, we found that many of them never entered, were never captured by the health system or by Life Childline. It was done here in Cape Town. It was Khayelitsha, and Khayelitsha had a single child sexual abuse NGO that were giving children counseling services. Remember the Tutuzelas give only brief counseling, there is no experts there. And actually what I was surprised is that we only had one service and then there was a waiting list. And so when mothers are given, I mean, we've got excellent TCCs, Tutuzela Care Center. So what happened, the woman comes in with her child and then they go through quite a nice extensive treatment. At the end, they're given an appointment to go and see somebody at, I'm the name, Nonneba. At Nonneba, they might go or they might not go. If they do go to Nonneba, there is a waiting list of 2 months. So after two, so this child has never been seen by any mental health counselor. So after 2 months, the child somehow seems okay. And the mother said, we didn't bother to go because it means taking time off work. And these are the children that still demonstrate evidence of mental health. So really, the study has shown us that there are huge barriers in the delivering of services that we do not have. We should be experts. I always say that there's so much trauma in South Africa. There's so much violence that South African psychologists and counselors should be experts in managing mental health. And we're actually not. I know we've got very little of these service providers. But children in particular, it's very specialized. When we spoke to the counselors at TCCs and asked them, so why don't you try and help these children? They said, it's very difficult to work with children. It is a speciality, and we've got very few specialists. So this study has shown us these gaps, and we've written it up, and we can share it with you if we need to. So I think we've kind of spoken about the impact already, about the impact of this adversity, in particularly maltreatment and adversity that we spoke about, the neglect, the emotional abuse, that it had on women and on men. We see that in women there was an increased risk for HIV among women who experienced emotional sexual abuse as a child. We see depression, we see alcohol abuse in adulthood among women who experience emotional neglect and sexual abuse as a child. When we look at men, we see alcohol abuse as an adult associated with having a very hard childhood. We're very hard on young boys. We give them a really hard childhood. There's lots of discipline. There's lots of abuse and beating. And that impact on alcohol abuse later as an adult. So it affects most. And we also see it in suicidality, and we also see it in HSV too, which is a very huge risk factor for HIV. So what we have seen in our research is this very broad impact. It's a huge impact that it has, and that we've documented, it's seen, but we need to talk about how do we deal with it and with our services. Are adequate.
I mean, it's very important because it affects the ability of the child, to perform well at school, to concentrate, and to sleep adequately. So often, school failure may be a result of depression or post-traumatic stress disorder because of abuse, and there's very little support for these children. So we just wanted to speak about a violence exposure. So this was a study that we did in Johannesburg amongst Indian coloured, white and black adolescents, and we were interested in the post-apartheid child, irrespective of race, and to see what was happening to them. And these kids were matched for socioeconomic status, and you can see that. This is a very bad start. It doesn't project very well. But if you have a look at your things, you will see that the point we want to make is that there was a high prevalence of exposure to violence, both in the family and in the community, and experience of violence by family members in the community and in the community. And this was irrespective of race. And if you look at in this group of our sexual abuse, you can see that that irrespective of race, so this is not a racial issue, is that whether you're white, black, Indian, or coloured, in South Africa, you're going to be you're going to have reports of sexual violence against you. And so that's an important thing that we make sure that kids from all racial groups do have access to services, and that we don't think that any child is immune from violence because of their race. So in terms of interventions, trying to find interventions that are worked are very difficult. We have to try and change society almost. We almost have to change society. And so some of the work that the MRC does and what Naima does is trying to find first of all, to try and understand what is the burden of the disease and of the violence, and we've shown it to you, and then to look at some of the interventions. And I'm going to ask Naima to lead you through some of the interventions that the MRC has done or is planning to do to try and address some of these issues.
Okay, so we've presented you quite horrific stories, but what's most important is prevention. So we do not want child abuse or child murders to happen at all. And what we've seen, and the interventions really should be driven by what we know about the risk factors, right? So we see different age groups have different risk factors, and what has across the world, also globally, people are now showing that parenting interventions are important and has an impact. And like the Honourable Chair said right at the beginning, and I was very glad she said it, it's about evidence, science, that we need to use science and evidence that things work. We cannot just take programs from all over and because it looks nice or somebody's given funding towards it. We need to use evidence-based interventions to deal with this problem. So because we've been working with young children and teens, we have one other intervention that we're not mentioning here is Stepping Stones. Stepping Stones is an intervention that was developed, but it was mainly looking at prevention of intimate partner violence and HIV. But it, because it was working with young people, it had a lot of impact on young men's self-esteem, on their understanding about how to communicate, and it actually had possibly an impact about them being adults. So the next intervention that we're currently testing is called SCORCO, and I've given you a little in your pack you have a SCORCO, thing, and SCORCO is an intervention that's being tested in Gauteng at the moment, in Gauteng schools. It has got a multifaceted school intervention. So number one, we develop a life orientation workbook for grade 8. And this is based on the theory of our understanding of violence and gender inequality. A second part of the intervention is working with the teachers, doing workshops with them to enable them to do the LO curricula. And then we also have workshops to build their skills and also to as well as clubs for teenagers. And the third intervention is with parents, a parenting intervention. So we bring the parents in on a Saturday and they and the teens together in a workshop are learning about how to communicate, how to positive discipline. We're teaching them positive. It's amazing how the teachers are taking on the positive discipline within the school. This is a randomized control trial. It's currently, we've just collected the first lot of data. The results is only going to be available in 2016, unfortunately. But here is a picture of the learner book, the LO book, and we have got, do we have time to show you a video about it?
Maybe we can stop for now and see the video after some members have actually commented.
Okay. We've got 3-4 more slides summarizing.
Okay, let's finish then.
Okay. All right. I think this is the summary slides in any case.
We are all aware of the South African Constitution that every child has the right to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse and degradation, and we are obligated as a society and as South African citizens to prevent violence against children, to protect children from further harm if they have experienced violence, and to support and treat children to restore their physical and psychological well-being post experiencing violence, and we are obligated to do that. And so we just want to summarize. I think we painted you a burden, and I think we've said all of this, that we have a high, kids in this country are exposed to high levels of violence, irrespective of race group, and that we do need systematic interventions to help them stop there.
Okay.
Thank you very much with this very important presentation you have made to the honorable members of this portfolio committee to date. But indeed, while I say thank you for now, I still have time to actually formally say that. I understand some members need to leave to other committees. They have sent me some apologies. But I can't allow you honorable members to leave without saying anything with regards to this particular presentation. I say so because some of the programs that were presented to this committee by the department, honorable members will remember that, sought to address directly this problem. Because the department has come with a comprehensive approach and focusing on family protection. You've mentioned that if the family is disintegrated, violence and so on, there will be this particular product, unfortunately. Also, the department has committed itself to deal with early childhood from within the womb, especially the 1,000 days postpartum, which means then, although this report has not been in the tables of the minister and in our table, there is a sense that not all is well. But I'm amazed. You mentioned Eastern Cape. I don't know where exactly you went. But I think, as I sit here, I know areas where, as we sit here, there are children who are naked in the true sense, who are actually out there looking after the cattle. I remember giving one a juice. I was from a meeting, and this juice, the one that you have to use something to suck the straw, and it was about 5 p.m. He was sitting next to the door while the kegler there. It was a little bit cold, all naked. Okay. But he struggled to get off the straw. And I asked, is it your first time? He said, I've never seen this, and I don't know how it tastes. So for us today, as members of parliament, as we sit here, I can confirm all of us feel a confirmation that there are strides that are being taken, but the problem is huge and can't be dealt with by the department only. I'm giving members to not necessarily ask questions because I think it is clear, but I would rather appreciate more the recommendations are there. The recommendations from those who are doing the research. But the research has been presented to the honorable members for them to do something, because it's only them who can do something. Can I then acknowledge, let me start with the gentleman, and then I will go to Honorable Kopana, because she said she's leaving. Then others, Honorable Fandermeva, I've noted your hand, 1, 2, 3, 4. But let me start with the gentleman, please.
No, thanks, I'll be brief. I think we also need to welcome the report, the research findings. But what was clear to me is that I have not picked up anything relating to people with disabilities. And also, with regard to the rural area. So my two questions will be based on that. The first one is that, what is the situation around violence against children with disabilities? Have any studies been done on this issue? so that we get a true reflection. Secondly, is that what is the actual situation in the deep, deep rural areas? If any studies been done in that regard, and what were the findings? And I also would like to get any recommendations to that effect, so that we have a holistic understanding of the situation. Lastly, we have 9 provinces in South Africa. You have mentioned the Eastern Cape, the chairperson has also mentioned the Eastern Cape. Out of the 9 provinces, give us a sketch which province is highest in terms of child abuse and all that, so that as government we must be able to understand where should we intervene. Thanks, Chair, for those brief questions that you afforded me.
I know this is going to be difficult to limit time while it is discussed, because this topic is touching. Mm-hmm. I will now go to Honorable Kopana, Honorable Wilson, Honorable Van der Merwe, and Honorable Sengi, in that once you pop your hand up, so let me take it that way and then backwards. Definitely so.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation, though it was very touchy and very emotional. And I also agree that as a country, we are trying to do certain things, but the pace is very slow. And on the same note, I also want to support that Mabilo when you talk about disability. According to the presentation, I think it's slide 6, one of the risk factors for violence against children, you clearly said, is disability. And I get worried because, if you remember the UN Convention on the Right of Children, the Right of Children was done in South Africa. And secondly, I realized that I think it's 2 years ago, as a country, we failed to comply in terms of our reporting obligation on the Convention on the Rights of People with Disability. I want to find out what is your opinion on that if we fail to comply our obligatory obligations to report on that. And my second question is, I do understand Medical Research Council is one of the credible institutions, and I believe what you are doing is quite right, and as a country we need to benefit and to take anything that you are advising us to do. But my question is, what are the challenges that we face as a country, especially in terms of your recommendations, what you recommend, because your presentation should have been done to different departments, because this is a card-crossing issue, not only for the social development. What are the challenges? Why government we don't take your recommendations or all the interventions that we introduce? What is it that we can do, or what are those challenges? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, ladies, for an enlightening presentation. I think the statistics that we've seen today are alarming. And taken into account that these are 2009 statistics, and the period between 2009 and 2014, the unemployment rates have increased, the poverty has substantially increased in this country, and if that is an indicator of the tendency to sexual violence or of any violence, then I suspect that the current statistics are probably even more alarming. My question around that I'm trying to lead to is, this is obviously, a lot of this is on stuff that can be reported. So I suspect that the figures might be actually a little bit lower than what they are in reality, because there is a tendency for people, particularly in terms of rape and particularly in terms of child abuse, where people are discouraged for whatever reason it is, inadequate police, you know, treatment by police, lack of victim empowerment centres, all of those kind of things, to actually report this. Could you give us an indication of what you think might be, are we 5% out, are we 10% out? How bad, what would it be in reality if we had more cases reported? Because I think this is one of the issues. People do not report these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and I would also like to align myself to the previous speakers who have thanked you for the wonderful presentation. I must say that as a person who, I'm really passionate about the rights of children and women, and I think when one reads this, then I acknowledge that the chair is saying that our government and our country is trying to do its best, but once you look at these findings, we must accept that we are failing our children in many ways. And I would like to ask, you talk about the intervention, and I think this is a very commendable intervention at the school, and it's clearly that we need this type of intervention at each school. So I wanted to know, you talk about Gauteng schools, how many schools is this program being rolled out to, and whether you have any future plans to roll it out to other provinces. And then just also to add to my previous colleague speaking about the issue of children with disabilities, I think I would also be interested to hear any sort of data on this, because, for example, recently during constituency period, I went to one ward in a very rural area, and one found four children in a few houses just close to one another, where the children are A, not going to school, they are disabled, and they are abused. Then I visited another area, for example, where a child is receiving a disability grant. The child again is kept in a side room in the house. One, the child sees almost none of that disability grant. Child has very little clothing and other toiletries, for example. When this child is helped by social workers and maybe other family members who want to intervene and take this child to the police, that child is unable to speak to the police.
Honourable member, sorry. I really indeed want to be very respectful and honest. But I think rather than giving us your experiences, please say whatever you say, because you are eating from your time.
I was just about to conclude, Chairperson, to say that I agree that it's a crisis, and I would like to hear whether they've got any data.
Thank you very much. Can I urge honourable members that we use our time to actually get more information for us, because we will still sit together as a portfolio and continue bringing what they have said to what we have experienced and the way forward. Please.
Yes.
I said in a row. The role is going to be Honourable Dikok, Honourable Maxim, Honourable, yeah, always coming last, but it's okay, come in, and then thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation that you did. I just want to ask two clarity questions and then just two short comments. The first one is on slide 12, the child sexual assault slide. It's stated there that between 40 to 50% of the rapes reported in South Africa to the police are children under 8 years. I was just 18 years. I mean, how many of these cases are babies, say, children younger than 5 years old? And then on slide 31, the reported sexual violence, I found it quite interesting that it says 17% amongst whites. And coloureds, for example, only 5%, which I think is a substantial difference. And I mean, somewhere in the presentation, the conclusion is drawn and that poverty plays an important role, but the perception is often there that, you know, poverty is not amongst the white people. So is this a issue of reporting, that the white people are more reported more than, say, for example, coloured people or black people? Just some clarity on that slide. And then I would just like to have your view on the importance of specialized skill dealing particularly with sexual assault and children and rape, etc. Because we have various shelters, and I please don't understand me incorrectly, I think there's a very important role for counselors to play. But I often get the feeling, for example, that you also mentioned it, like anxiety and post-traumatic stress, it's complex issues, and that it actually needs specialized people. And the shortage of specialized skills in this sector, what type of crisis, is it a crisis or not? And then just quickly, lastly, will you be doing any research, or are you doing any research on the role of the state? But like my other colleagues referred to, like more specific matters, because I think we've done a lot in terms of legislation and policy, but I think there's issues around the practical implementation thereof. For example, how do you police something that happens in the house? That's one example, the lack of social workers in South Africa and so on. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think I'm covered by the previous speakers, and I would like to thank the presentation done by the two beautiful ladies. Indeed, Chairperson, is very touching to listen to such presentation. I don't know if it's just because we are also coming from the Women's Month. Some of us have been exposed to such a presentation too, because we just wrap up our Women's Month. In this document, Chairperson, I think on page 3, situation analysis, I think it has captured very correctly that one of the causes of the violence against children is poverty. And I would like to see the research to come with to come up with some of the proposals as government how to intervene, because we can go on and on and on crying, because I don't know how many times have I cried. Because when you listen to a presentation, if your background is from the informal settlement, you know exactly what you are talking about. It's our daily basis, as the Chairperson was also saying, making that the example of a child who was also failing to drink a juice. So we know exactly what is happening on the ground. But we are very much concerned on the intervention side in order for the government to be capacitated in order to deal with such issues. Thank you, Chair.
The two honorables, one of you.
Chairperson, thank you. Thank you to the Research Council for the report and the research that has been done. And one needs to welcome that, especially what other members have said. Issues of children, violence against children, as this committee is one of the things that is in our heart. But my question on the, I just wanted to know, when you talk about violence against children, you cannot separate the issue of substance abuse, because it's one form of the violence. It may be a substance, but we know that it's a violence to the children. And what you said, that you touched that you are from Barra, or you are having sex with Barra. I'm from Gauteng, and in Gauteng, there's this substance called Nyaope that is hitting our kids from 9 years till 20 or 25. What are you doing? Did you ever thought of taking the research to assist? As you know that most of the children are dropouts now from the school. Some of them are in the prison. Some of them are not staying at home. As small as 9 years. If the research council did check, maybe to do the research on the issue of now. And as you said that you are working with the schools, I think the issue of bullying, it's killing, and it's more in the schools, not only in Gauteng, nationally. And I'm worried if down in rural area, they can't even differentiate what is bullying amongst the learners, because it's easy in the cities to see this is a bullying trend. But down in rural areas, what is happening, because they can't even track this is a bullying and it's happening things that make people, young people, not to come back. And the report is addressing the issues of the MDGs of 2015, and I thank you because the eradication of poverty.
Can you please bring your mic to your
mic? Okay. It's going together with the how to eradicate poverty. So we do welcome this and hope maybe, Chair, this report, we must be part of the implementation of taking it to of our oversight everywhere we go. Maybe it won't be even the last time we meet the research council on that end. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chairperson. I won't be long, because many of the members touched, you know, the approach within government, that it's a multi-disciplinary approach, and even when it comes to the stakeholders, etc. But and then, you know, our legislation that we have in place, and then the programs to prevent violence. But I'd like to ask the Research Council, did you in any way do some bit of research on the impact government policies, programs, and legislation has in preventing or intervening in violence against children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member.
Yes, maybe I must say that you also include this arrangement. That as researchers, and you are partners to government, and you have experienced how government has put forward its transformation, how they have said, if we have seen the programs that relate to child protection, etc., including the laws, I think it's a lot, and how much budget is being put on that. So I think the recommendation before you leave, your recommendations are very good, but what I think is not being done is the issue of who is the family. In all what we are talking about, where is the family in this whole process? Probably if there was destruction and destabilization of a family unit that we are crippling with things because you give this mother 300 rands, when the 300 rands goes to beer and not to the child. So I think missionaries at some stage were able to put forward early childhood, whatever name they were using, but they were looking after the children. Most people who could have been gone the other way, they were really molded in that what you call boarding hostel education linked with molding a child that comes from a very, very bad destabilized home. I know I've never had a home because my father could have worked in mines and my mother could have been behind the plow and I was on the back. That still exists. So I think when we talk about these matters, we must push towards a transformation because the issue here is also the same families that were never rebuilt. The same migration that is characterized by Marikana. And many a time children are left at home. The mother joins the father elsewhere in the migration labor system. So I would want a situation when we make recommendations, we combine what Honorable Maxine is talking about. The issue of, are the families equal? Is there a sufficient protection to the family? And I do know in a poor situation, when the father is no longer, or when the mother was not married to the father, because we must also talk about, do we have parents? And who is the parent? Who is actually looking after the child? Who receives grant? Is it the mother? And the child looked after by grandmother? So there is this balance of the status of the South African society, which has got totally no social cohesion because of its past. This is post-war. And I think the building blocks must address fundamental issues. Can I then give you, but I wanted to give you how I feel about this and how this program of government and current budget is going to be utilized in order to achieve the best.
Thank you very, very much for your input. It's very, as a researcher who works in the area, it's very heartening to see that I could come to policymakers and to members of this committee, and where you listen and hopefully you can use our information. Firstly, I'm going to try and address, and then Glenda will also address some of this. I think everybody has agreed it's extremely complex issue, and it does require multi-sectorial responses, but it mustn't be so complex that it makes us lame, that we say we cannot do anything about this. We've overcome apartheid, so this issue is maybe similarly as big. But we've got to start somewhere. So we, as the Medical Research Council, we obviously have, and I think Brenda will talk about it, there's also the Human Sciences Research Council, and there are other bodies that are also dealing on the issue of children and disabilities. Our focus has been because the impact it has on health, and particularly because of the mortality and the mental health impact it has. So I'll try and address some of the very first issue, and a common issue was about disabilities and the rural communities. Now, I actually want to say to the committee members, South Africa has never ever done a national violence against children survey. We don't know really how big the problem. These are small surveys. These are small. We have never ever done one. We currently in discussion with some partners where they're possibly going to give us money to do a national violence against women. Because this should actually be surveys. This should be done annually or every second year. Like people were saying, 2009 is a long time ago. Do we know if whether it's going up or whether it's going down? So just to say there's never been a big... The only national study that's been done was the child homicide study. So that's national. We're giving you a national figure. But like I said earlier, we didn't have enough samples to talk about provincial differences. So no, I cannot say which provinces has got a bigger or smaller problem. Then about rural areas, and I know that this is probably where the problem is exacerbated, where there is many other factors that contributes to child violence against children being even more a bigger problem. And we do not yet have, and what I'm hoping is that when we do the National Violence Against Women, against Children survey, we will do a decent enough survey where we can stratify it, and we've already identified how we want to measure the very deep rural areas and divide it into stratification in terms of that. So hopefully it can't be done overnight, and maybe in 2 years' time, we will have information about provincial differences and rural areas. Disabilities, again, no, I don't have figures for disabilities. We have started work only on violence against women who are disabled. We've just started the program in our unit, and that data, but what is actually going to happen is the DHS, the Demographic and Health Survey, which is going to happen next year, has got questions on disability, it will have questions on violence against women, it will have questions on children. We've added 3 questions on violence against children in the Demographic and Health Survey. So hopefully by the end of 2015, we will have that data, both the rural and the disability data. There were questions about really knowing what works. Yes, I think with the Scorecore project, we are trying to use what we know about risk factors in developing interventions. It's very important that we know what works. And we've got a program that's been funded by DFID. Where we have been asked to look at what works. And so there's been a huge call for people from, actually it's globally, not just South Africa, but it's led by us in our unit. And we will learn a lot. South Africa will learn a lot about what's happening in other developing countries. So again, this is just starting, but people are serious about where are the evidence about what works to prevent, not just for responses, but prevent. So again, it's something to look forward to. One of the honourable members asked about low. Is this figure low or high? I don't know because we haven't got comparisons. We can say really we think it is an estimate, and when we do research, we actually rather err on it being lower so that we're not being attacked by people that are saying we're punching up the numbers. Because we do know, sexual violence is often not reported, we know that. Children don't know it happens to them, so they don't report it to their parents. And with the child murders, since the, it's gone out of my head, what is that? Sudden infant death syndrome. It's very common way of children, but it's really child murders, you see, didn't they? But we didn't know, so we didn't add it to our... So a proportion of the SIDS deaths are actually homicide, but we didn't add it. So yes, we do have a lower figure than what's expected. You ask about SCORCOR, about the intervention, when it's rolled out. It is a randomized control trial, meaning that certain schools, 30 schools in Gauteng were chosen. It took us a very long time to work with the Department of Education. I just want to mention it's not easy to do research where you really struggle to work with departments who don't always are convinced that we're doing useful work. So it took us a long time to work with the Gauteng of Education to allow us to enter the schools. It will not be rolled out until we know it works. I think it's very important that we need to know that it works. Although there are other, they are very keen. They've seen the small little evidence that it works. And they already ask us if they cannot roll it out. But as scientists, we are saying, wait, we just need to be patient. We need to know whether it works. Because what if it doesn't work? So that's the SCORCOR rollout. Age breakdown of the South African, the SAPS data, it is about SAPS providing us that data by age, and they often do not do that. It would be fantastic if this committee could go to SAPS and say, please, if you present your data of sexual abuse, present it by age group, particularly in children in 1 year age group, we can then see where the big risks are. We talked about, there was a question about whether it is a specialized area and the lack of social workers. I think, yes, I believe it is a specialized area to work with children. We kind of know how to work with women that's been violated. We're just about getting it right. We're not perfect yet either. We don't really use interventions that's also been tested. But with children, certainly it's a huge, huge hole there in terms of specialized services. And it would be fantastic if the committee could identify that as something that they would want to raise. I think there was a question on substance use. I think Glenda will talk about the other work that was happening in the MRC. And somebody asked about the impact of policies and government policies. And so it's not something that we do, but at UCT there's a Child Health Institute, and it's being headed up by Shanaz Matthews, who actually led the child homicide study. And she and their unit very, very closely work on issues about child policies and its impact on children. And I know they do a child gauge every year, and the child gauge that's going to come out in a couple of months' time is going to be on violence against children. So we're looking forward to that one. I think I kind of covered.
I mean, I think with the issue is that when because I come from an HIV field, we always say know your epidemic, and we don't know this epidemic, and the only way we're going to know our epidemic of child violence is to do the surveys that we're planning, so that we can look at the burden, the distribution, where it's happening, and plan our interventions according to knowing our epidemic. So I think that's a very critical thing that we have to do urgently, is to understand the burden of violence against children. In terms of the data that I presented on racial distribution, so this was a survey in 16 to 18 year olds in Johannesburg, in various areas. So we chose it was in Kliptown, Deep Kloof, just outside JD, the hospital, just outside West Dean, that poor white area just outside West Dean, and an area in Lanasia. And we try to match all the children on socioeconomic status. And so these were so the report we saw is about children of the same age group, different racial groups, but matched by socioeconomic status. And these are small samples, so that's why the point was that if you had to do confidence intervals, there would be no difference. The confidence intervals would overlap. And the point I was trying to make is that violence against children knows no racial boundaries. And knows no socioeconomic boundaries. You know, you can be a rich white kid and be abused, or you could be living in a shack and being abused. So it's not about race.
And it's not about socioeconomic status, it's about the way we value our children, and that gets to me the issue around social norms. You know, we grew up and we were beaten, and we thought that was normal to be beaten at school. Mm-hmm. And only as we got older did we realize that's not good to be bullied or beaten. And it's only when we change social norms and change the way we view children will we make any inroads in this. You know, when women realize they shouldn't be beaten and children realize they shouldn't be bullied, and teachers realize that they shouldn't treat children this way. It's only when we change societal norms can we really address the issue around violence. And it's something that's about parenting, particularly young girls. I mean, who ever got a lesson on parenting? You know, sometimes we may not know how to parent. And so those are issues that we have to address. You know, and those are campaigns, national campaigns, about how we should parent and how we should value our children. In terms of the substance abuse, I'm from Gauteng. I worked at Kasani Baragwanath Hospital all my life until now. I'm in Cape Town. There is an issue around drug abuse also. We don't know our epidemic, you know, so we hear these pockets, and we need national surveillance on drug abuse and how and what kind of drugs we're using. We do have the MRC does have a alcohol, drug and tobacco unit that's studying the effects of drug use and prevalence and looking at interventions. These social behavioral interventions to address these kind of things are very hard, and we have to be able to penetrate the communities within which we work, and so they're ongoing. And you know, we need to continue to do research to try and understand the burden. And so in terms of government policy, some of the hardest things to do is to take government policy and put it into practice. And you know that we need, you know, we need government, we need researchers, and we need communities, and we need departments to be able to put policy into practice. And that comes with mental health. You know, we do need to train people on mental health. We do need to train people how to manage children in the healthcare sector. And we're very good. South Africa is very good at rolling out antiretroviral therapy and vaccinations, but we're very poor at managing mental health in our country, and particularly children. And so one of the things we do have to develop in the health sector is and it's the world over, it's not just South Africa, whether you're in the US or in Europe, wherever you are, mental health is a big problem. People are marginalized, they don't get care, and so it's a global problem, and we need to address it, we need to address it in South Africa as well.
Now that we have finished the clarities and the recommendations, I would also urge the scientists to also add in their vocabulary some indigenous ways of managing human beings, because in any way this would be a holistic investigation. As to, you can't separate looking after the children from a family life. And we, all of us in this house, can agree. Things that happened today were not happening many years ago. And there were no social workers, I can tell you. And these communities were very, very organized. There were no police. All these things have come over time. But sometimes I fail to understand whether there will be at some stage one police, one family in South Africa, or one family, one social worker in South Africa. Because seemingly we're no longer thinking about the role that the communities themselves were playing in order to be a family, to be a society, to be a village. It takes a village to mold and look after the child and produce a better citizen. I think we must ask, are we talking to everyone or to traditional partners? My question would be, I've not asked the department as a chair, when they have the public hearings, do they use the original traditional database? Have they spoken to Christians?
many leaders in this country came from missionary schools. Great men, because there was no other support. It was only the Christian mission schools. Have we actually related to them that there is a developing backward moving in terms of a better society? I remember sometime history was not important, but IT was becoming very, very important. It is only today that people are beginning to say, without history, you won't know where you come from, you won't know where you're going to. But I think it is going to be critical to think on a daily basis, who is in the village? Do we all need to have gone through a classroom and a school to be able to look after the children that were looked after by illiterate people when there was no school and there was nothing? I think this research is, for me, neglecting one other big area to be investigated that talks about what was a family. And how was the relationship within a family? I know social workers can tell us that there were many types of family, extended families, nuclear families. Those studies can tell you how much, when you look into different societies in the world and you look into the family life, which is no longer there, there is something that must be checked. Giving a teenager or an adolescent a house, RDP house, who is going to be a parent in that house? Give an 18-year-old a house and you say, you now own an RDP house, you are on your own. Taking your kids not to a university, but that kid is going to stay in a flat and is being away from the family for the first time. So I think for us to be able, we must be holistic in approach. If we take one side scientifically and forget that a human being is a social being and depends on a society that has got social cohesion, I can tell you we have not spoken to traditional leaders. They are there, they have a system, they have a house nationally, they have got organizations, they are actually in charge of some part of the society. You can also speak to the church, I said, but there are many. Why are we not talking about the effect of traditional healers in the ritual killings and in the myth of saying, if I involve myself in a rape of a child, I'll be cured of HIV. So I think this is a broad topic, and I do appeal to members that it can't be helping if we think the government will do everything. I remember someone saying government is to be blamed even if circumcision goes wrong. Circumcision has never went wrong in many, many years in memory. How much it is dangerous today. Should we go and conduct a scientific research that they are being killed by dehydration, etc.? Do we look at the part that has been lost? And also, that's why I'm saying a social being will only be complete if there is comprehensive, holistic investigation and to answer many, many questions. Because the other killings that are there, many children die because their mothers and fathers are attacked and their houses burnt down because they are said to be thieves.
or sometimes they are said to belong to a counselor who is corrupt, or sometimes they are witches. So there are many instances where I know when you do a scientific study, you focus and you eliminate what you are not looking for. You actually focus and report on what you initially want to study, and you eliminate and clean what you were not looking for. But what we're not looking for might be what is the causative factor. So we are not going to take this report just as it is. We will have to scrutinize it, to reflect on it, and to actually verify with the existing societies, and we'll be happy if we know the exact areas. Because in this country, in Gauteng, they have got their unique challenges. Totally different, because every family has got to wake up and go and search for work. But in Mutu, the situation in KwaZulu-Natal will be something, in Papalong, somewhere in Matatye, it will be something, because the mother is there on a daily basis. But the father, the family unit is not complete, because one is involved in migration labor system. Well, how does government intervene to have a home life? For example, the very matter of what we call these homes, orphanages. When you become a separate animal, you are kept together with other orphans, and there's no interaction with the broader society, because social development believes my child is your child. Your child is my child. And if there's no parent, I must play a parental role. When I am isolated out there, and our situation is that we don't have families, all of us here, which society do we belong to? When we, another issue, the disabilities. People with disabilities insist they don't really want to be mainstreamed, to go to ordinary schools for everybody, so that I can develop an understanding that he has some lack of capacities here and there, and learn to assist as we grow together, as we study together. But now they should be separate. They are in a disability school, as if there will be a disability a school where they will teach only, or an employment that will belong to them all, while we are saying, make South African education accessible equally, and you universalize every other thing. So I think we will come and engage on this particular research. And I'm going to go out of my way and bring the other stakeholders that never get your presentations and reflect on it, your traditional leaders, especially the House and Contralesa, the Council of Churches, to be part and parcel of such presentations and voice their own reflection and observation of what is going around them. We can't be able to go to Gwagwa, conduct a research, go to Tokwe, another research, then it will be a national research indeed. But how long? It will take years and years. But if this portfolio committee can go out of its way and provide a platform and challenge everyone, whether it's department subs, whether it's health, whether it's education, for us to be under one roof and you make this presentation, so that they themselves don't have a hearsay. They listen to professors, scientists, who say, whatever you are doing, whatever has caused it, but this is the mirror. This is what is going on. These are the statistics. Statistics can never be a tool to politically fight each other. This is calling for nation building. whether white, whether yellow, whether black, but all of us, we should be coming together and say, when will we have a social coherent society? How are we going to make our schools work? Because our schools are not working if you have this kind of situation where teachers can see a woman out of a child who is supposed to be like his or her child, whether it's a boy or a girl. So I think we will take this very, very serious. But we will take this recommendation that says, let's hear other voices. Let's hear other research. Let's take 2 or 3 days, honorable members, and listen to the voiceless. And actually, the very parents must have a say to say, in my situation, I can relate this story. People must have a story to tell about their growing up and about some causative factor you are actually relating. Because some people who come from a slum, if I may use that, come from the worst, but can be the most disciplined, peace-loving and kind person. Why is that? You grow up in the worst area, worst environment, but you become so kind and you utilize your background to ensure that it must never happen again. So our study must be really accommodative in order for us to make it a vehicle and a tool. Definitely we'll follow all legal processes of presenting your report as it is, adding what we are talking about and how we have reflected as all honorable members. Bring into this engagement the department. We'll not send it to the department. We'll present it to the department. The department will reflect. We'll take all legal processes towards the house. But how I wish we can present a fully scrutinized and interrogated product to begin to say, what does it mean to the traditional leaders? What does it mean to peace-loving South Africans? What does it mean to the elite, the educated people in this country, the leaders? What does it say to those who deal with economy? In Brazil, I don't know whether you in ghettos. I've been there for 6 times. And in those ghettos, they resorted to something called the EduKid College, where children are, all of them, collected every morning to a college that starts from all up until grade 12, and they can't be gangsters because they go and sleep in their homes, enjoy home life. Tomorrow they go to a homely made arrangement to meet all, because they were tired of having drug lords and all that. So such experiences must be looked into. And then this instrument and your being and your presence will continue to be a weapon for government, not to shoot from the dark, but to be always guided by a scientific but more comprehensive reports, like your human, you said, human science studies, that will make it to be more holistic rather than very, very scientific. Thank you very much. You are our heroes in this country. And you, because of your information, your ability to work, we are able to exist amongst other countries in the world that can say, there is a little that we are doing. This is what we study independently of government. And this is the interventions that we are trying. When we have time, I can really say where you are, where the department is, there is some understanding. Looking into what they said they will do. University of KwaZulu-Natal is doing Mikonzo, isn't it? Is it Mikonzo? where they go into a village, conduct a research, facilitate. I listened to a very good presentation by those professors as well, what they do village-based. But I also said to them, it would be good if you meet other like-minded organizations so that they can observe and make general observation of that university's work. And you will get another university doing something else and something else. But we have a very good passion for working with tertiary institutions because we are not in any way going to pay you. So we will be able to source from yourselves very good quality research, but because you're not pleasing us, you want us to know. If I appoint this young lady, she will want to please me and sometimes become subjective because I'm the boss. Mm-hmm. But you are known too far from me being your boss. You tell me that, Makapa, this is how ugly you are. I know today how ugly we are. Thank you very much for your endeavors. Continue doing that work. We link our researchers, I've told them, with you so that they can also find a way of verifying some issues that we can't understand and explain better to us. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Those members of the society that have come to you, belonging to this research society, continue, my heroes, continue, good South Africans, to work with them so that we can, at the end of the day, know what diagnosis is there and get a better medicine. Thank you.
Then I therefore declare the meeting closed. While I request the members of parliament to remain a little bit.